for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Journalist David Rode was imprisoned for 10 days in 1995 while covering the war in Bosnia. Once freed, he promised his family, friends, and editors he would never put them through such an ordeal again. But after agreeing to interview a Taliban commander in Afghanistan 2 years ago, Rode was kidnapped once more. This time, he was held for 7 months. His wife of 2 months was thrown into the anguish of hostage negotiations. The couple has written a book about their experience. It's titled A Rope and a Prayer. David Rode and Kristen Mulvihill join me in the studio. We will take your calls, 800-433-8850. David Rode is a reporter for the New York Times. He's the winner of 2 Pulitzer Prizes in journalism. His wife, Kristen Mulvihill, has been a fashion and photography editor for several women's magazines. She's also a painter and illustrator. I look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having us here.
David Rode, I want you to tell us what happened on the day you were abducted.
I was invited to an interview by a Taliban commander who had given interviews to 2 other foreign journalists, and I thought it would be safe. I met with one of those foreign journalists the night before we departed for the meeting, and she said, "You are American." She was a European journalist. "That's more dangerous, but I don't think he'll kidnap you." Instead, what happened when we drove to the meeting point the next morning was that Taliban gunmen blocked the road with a car as we were driving towards the meeting point. They then jumped in our car with Kalashnikov rifles. One got behind the steering wheel, one in the front passenger seat, and myself and my Afghan colleagues were in the back seat, and they sort of sped off down the road. A second car had been waiting for us with more gunmen in it. That followed us as a chase car. We thought about maybe trying to overpower the 2 men, but we really didn't think there was any chance, and that was the beginning of our 7 months and 10 days in captivity.
So they clearly knew you were coming.
Yes, the commander who invited me to the interview, you know, set me up. And in hindsight, I think the previous 2 interviews may have been part of an effort to kind of win the trust of journalists. He may have been sort of plotting this for, you know, it was at least a year beforehand, and he was waiting for the right target to come along, and unfortunately that was me.
You had been married for just 2 months.
Yes.
Kristen, he didn't even tell you.
He didn't tell me about the interview, no. And initially I was really upset. I was angry that he hadn't told me. I realized quickly, you know, it was the kidnapper's responsibility. The blame was on them for kidnapping him. But I was surprised he hadn't consulted me.
Surprised is a kind word.
I was convinced. I mean, I look, it was obviously a mistake and a lapse on my part, and I deeply regret it.
Why did you not tell her?
I first of all, I thought she would say no. I thought she would order me and say, "Do not go to this interview." And, you know, in a kind of classic and, you know, embarrassing mistake, I avoided the confrontation. Because if she had said no, I wouldn't have gone to the interview. I would have obeyed the wishes of my new wife. I would not have, you know, contested it. And I had lost perspective. I talk in the book about competitiveness getting the best of me. I was working on a book that I hoped would be the culmination of 7 years of reporting on Afghanistan since 2001. Dozens of journalists have safely interviewed the Taliban. Again, this guy had done 2 previous interviews, and I felt like the book wouldn't be complete, you know, and I would be falling behind other journalists if I didn't have a Taliban interview. I had been down in Helmand province in the south for 2 weeks before doing the interview, and the Taliban had a tremendous resurgence there. They had a tremendous amount of popular support, And I really felt I needed to get that side of the story. But it, you know, it was a mistake, and I regret it.
How did you learn, Kristen, of his kidnapping?
I had actually just started a new job as photography director at Cosmopolitan magazine. I was in my office. It was a Monday afternoon. I was putting the finishing touches on some of our upcoming shoots, which at Cosmo, you know, they celebrate women's sexuality. So it was bachelors in their boxer shorts. I got a call from my brother-in-law, Lee, who had always been the point of contact in the case of a mishap in David's reporting trips. And we were newly married, so we hadn't switched the contact information, actually, at the times. And Lee was contacted by the FBI and then contacted me. You know, it was shocking. I just remember everything kind of standing still, feeling numb initially, and then thinking, you know, here it is. This is my worst fear come true.
Were you told not to say anything?
I was told not to say anything. And in fact, I left work. I was new to the job. I told the people I was working with that I had a family emergency and I had to leave work early. They were really gracious not to ask questions. And they were like, take all the time you need. And I very quickly, you know, was thrown into meeting with the FBI. I was trained how to take phone calls should David or the captors call me. The New York Times called me in and I met with Bill Keller, Arthur Sulzberger, several of David's editors and the legal counsel and, you know, expressed the desire to keep this out of the press. And they were fantastic in honoring my request.
Why did you want it kept out of the press?
Personally, I knew David would not want to be part of a news story. I was terrified, too, that if we went public, we would give the captors a platform, you know, to try to negotiate directly with our government, and it would be out of our hands. We also weren't dealing with legitimate government. We were dealing with extremists. We had a private security team that advised us not to go public as well.
And the New York Times, how did they feel about it?
You know, initially, I mean, it went against every instinct they have. You know, to share the news, to report the news. But they honored the family's request. There had been a case just before David's. It was Melissa Fung that had been kept out of the press as well. So there was somewhat of a precedent. But I, you know, the family was very firm on wanting to keep it quiet until we knew more information.
Kristen Mulvey-Hill, she and her husband, David Rode, have written a new book about his kidnapping, and it's titled A Rope and a Prayer. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. David, describe the people with whom you were kidnapped.
I was with an Afghan journalist, Tahir Ludin, and our driver, Asad Mangal. And one of the things we try to make clear in this book, there was hostility towards them. And the Taliban see any Afghan or Pakistani, for that matter, who cooperates with the U.S. government or works with foreigners as an enemy. They're not Muslims. And they face tremendous, you know, hostility. And, you know, in the end, I'm able to escape with the help of Tahir, and who's, you know, a moderate Afghan and a moderate Pakistani, which we can talk about later. The point of this is we don't want this story to be about, you know, terrible terrorists and for people to think that all Afghans and all Pakistanis are like the people who kidnapped me. Most of them don't support them. And, you know, the people who kidnapped me are more criminals than representative of Afghans or Pakistanis
or
Muslims.
How did they treat you? How did they treat the three of you?
We were treated very well. People talk a lot about the tribal culture in Afghanistan. Pashtun Wali is this tradition among ethnic Pashtuns, and that I was kidnapped by Pashtuns. And I was given bottled water. I was never beaten. It was very important for them to keep me healthy. And what emerged over time was this theme of hypocrisy. They were keeping me healthy because they called me the Golden Rooster, and they were, you know, expecting to get an enormous ransom. Their initial demands were $25 million and the release of 15 prisoners from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. One issue we found is that there's a European governments have paid for hostages in the past. It's not officially confirmed. The American government will not pay for hostages or release prisoners. So there's a real muddle in the kind of, there's no international policy on how to deal with this. So my kidnappers, you know, had these enormous expectations about the amount of money and prisoners they could get.
And what were your expectations, Kristen?
In terms of how to get him out?
In terms of what lay before you?
Before me, it was totally unknown territory. One of the things I did do early on, I did a bit of research. I talked to some former hostages that offered to speak with me. And I got a sense there was one gentleman, Jerry Van Dyke, who had been held in Pakistan the previous year. He sat down and told me kind of what he had been through. He mentioned Pashtunwali. He told me they wouldn't hurt David physically. But under Pashtunwali, you know, they'll treat you as a guest, but they can behead you at any time. So that was my greatest fear. I had no idea what they would do. I was coached that perhaps the demands over time would decrease and we should sort of drag out any negotiation. And I should be open to the idea of discussing money or appearing to be willing to do that in order to keep the captors calling, to spark a dialogue and to keep them calling.
How long was it before you were able to talk with David?
I spoke with David about a week and a half into the kidnapping. He actually phoned home.
How come?
Because they wanted to issue demands.
I see.
The key thing
through
that
your wife.
Yes. And the key thing, in the very first week, we were moved from Afghanistan into Pakistan. It was very clear when we were in Afghanistan that the Taliban feared the American military and they feared an American raid. They lied to us. They told us we had to get out at one. We were driven for several days, and then they had us get out of the car and walk through the mountains. We walked for 9 hours. They told me that we had to walk because we were going near an American military base, and in fact, we walked into the tribal areas of Pakistan. And once we were there, it was a Taliban mini-state. All of the checkpoints had been abandoned by Pakistani security forces and instead were manned by the Taliban. And my captors were completely relaxed, and that's where they had me make a satellite call and make their demands to
David Rode. He's a reporter for the New York Times. He and his wife, Kristen Mulvihill, have written a new book about his kidnapping. It's titled A Rope and a Prayer. And if you've just joined us, David Rode went through a harrowing experience. He was kidnapped by the Taliban when it was said, promised to him, that he was going to have an interview with one of the leaders of the Taliban. He was working for the New York Times at the time. He and his wife, Kristen Mulvihill, have now written a book about his seven-month experience behind the lines, as it were. It's titled A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Our first email is from David in Northport, Florida, who says, could you ask your guest about the New York Times keeping his abduction under wraps? It's clear in light of the WikiLeaks disclosure, the New York Times does not keep anything secret, even when the national security or human life is on the line. Yet they did not disclose his situation. I'm not saying they should have risked his life, but I think this shows the organization's hypocrisy.
I would politely disagree with the sender of the email. The New York Times has redacted the names of sources that were in the WikiLeaks documents, and the clear parameter is when it's a risk of someone's life, they don't publicize that. And in my case, it's very clear. I've talked to a half dozen other former hostages who were kidnapped around the world in places like Somalia and North Africa. There's very clear agreement that publicity, when you're kidnapped by jihadists, publicity only increases their expectations but what they can get is ransom or turns you into a political issue. The New York Times' policy on reporting kidnappings is that if the family of someone who's kidnapped, this can be an aid worker or a contractor, if the family requests that it not be publicized, they don't publicize it. The Times doesn't name, you know, sources who are afraid of losing their jobs. The Times doesn't name mob informants who testify in mob trials. And the WikiLeaks, there's only a select number that it's released, and it's redacted information from them. So it's, you know, I just politely disagree. It's not true. The paper's been responsible about what it reports and doesn't report. Embarrassing to the government is different than risking people's lives.
Kristen, tell me about your frustration in dealing with the people who apparently should have known what to do next. You said something about my tolerance for speculation about yes. when David may be released, coupled with chauvinism for the all-male team, is exhausted.
Yes, yes. And I have to say, you know, I'm grateful to our team. I had a love-hate relationship with everybody throughout this experience.
I'll
just
bet.
Because it was such a dramatic
of course.
Experience. But, you know, we had a lot of cooks in the kitchen. We had the lawyer from the New York Times, David McCraw, who was fantastic throughout. We had a private security team. We also had the FBI. We had the Times crisis management team. You know, all of them well-intentioned. It was a very sort of male-dominated effort, and former military, you know, former military soldiers and FBI and whatnot, and at times they would sort of compete with each other, and that was difficult to sort of wade through. And then, you know, early on, we really felt, and when I refer to we, it was myself and my brother-in-law Lee, David's brother, sort of sifting through things. It was really tough to get clear advice in the initial days on what we should do. And that was somewhat frustrating. As the case progressed, we had a lot of people involved because I didn't feel there was any one group that knew everything. I had an individual who was a close counsel to me, named Michael Simple, who leads an organization called Talk for Peace. He actually lives in Pakistan, and he was very aware of sort of the local customs. He helped me try to talk to Taliban elders, you know, to plead for David's release. He understood the cultural side of it. The security team was great in terms of, you know, advising to keep everything quiet. They didn't like to share information with other groups, like with the FBI and whatnot. So that was tricky at times. The FBI was fantastic in training me to take calls, but really their goal is to gather information. They can't negotiate directly. So.
Give me a sense of the kinds of calls that you took.
That I took. I had two calls from David, and then I had two calls from the captors. I think it was in March, which was a little more than midway through. They were not happy with how negotiations were going, and the captors had gone quiet for, I think, about 6 or 8 weeks. They would do that periodically. And I received a call at home late at night stating that they weren't happy with how things were going. And
Speaking in English.
To me in English, actually. And this was really striking. It was not just English, it was American. It was very casual. You know, they wanted to know what my progress was. I will say they never used particularly threatening language, which was shocking, but they were still asking for millions of dollars in prisoners. I had a recording device on my phone, so I recorded every call. I tried to look at the number on caller ID and text it to the FBI. Even though the FBI wasn't negotiating for us, we did keep them in the loop in terms of communications.
Tell me about these people. I realize they gave you bottled water. They didn't beat you. They didn't try to, apparently didn't try to threaten your life. But what were they like?
They lived in this alternate reality. They were completely convinced that this was a religious war. They felt they had been told that American soldiers were forcibly converting Afghan Muslims to Christianity. They sort of saw themselves as defending their nation from this vast international Christian, Jewish, and Hindu conspiracy. One suicide bomber I lived with believed that all Westerners were hedonists, only focused on the pleasures of this world.
How do you know he was a suicide?
Oh, he was very proud of it. He was. All the guards talked to about him as, you know, they introduced him as this young man, a young
Pakistani. And he's willing to give
his
life.
Yes, he's in training. They called it the fedayeen, this Arabic term, which was also used in Iraq. And I asked him, you know, won't you miss your family? It was a fascinating thing to see the mentality and how they turn these young men into suicide bombers. And he said he wouldn't miss his family at all, that the most important relationship to him was his relationship with God. And he wouldn't miss his brothers and sisters or his parents. And it was interesting because there are Saudi programs that try to de-radicalize militants when they're kind of, arrested. And one of the things they do is they force these young radicals to live with their families again, and they find that contact with family sort of kind of deprograms them. But it was this amazing kind of disdain for this world. This young man had been told that all Christians want to live for 1,000 years. He asked me if that was true. And he had also been told that a necktie was a secret symbol of Christianity. So they really lived in this, you know, this idea of being under threat and defending themselves from this vast conspiracy.
Give me a sense of how each day went, a typical day, if you will.
We had chores. I mean, it was, you know, they prayed 5 times a day, so it would begin with sort of the pre-dawn prayers.
And you were on the floor as well.
We were all living in this simple room. I mean, one of the ironies, and people think the Taliban live in caves. They don't live in caves. I was in Miranshah, which is the largest town in North Waziristan. It's this tribal area in Pakistan that this is where this Taliban mini-state thrives. We'd get up, have breakfast, you know. At one point, the guards were going off and taking bomb-making lessons from foreign militants in Miranshah. Two would stay and two would go off for their classes. Enormous explosions would go off in Miranshah, and the Pakistani forces that were in the one local military base never came off their base to investigate what was happening. And, you know, I spent my time pacing a lot. I listened to the radio.
How? What kind of radio?
They actually had a radio that the American military had given out to civilians in Afghanistan with a little hand crank on it, and just it was battery operated. Miranshah, again, is this very modern town. There was batteries to buy. I was given English language Pakistani newspapers. It was amazing. And so they let me listen to the BBC. And, you know, it was fascinating to be among these people who are so focused on the next world. And it led me to sort of miss, you know, we're not perfect by any measure here, but at least we sort of celebrate trying to improve this world and doing the best we can, you know, hearing shows about art and music and sort of celebrating humanity and human creativity. It was really thrilling because it was such a dark existence these young men were trapped in.
And give me a sense of the kind of tone that was on the telephone between the two of you when you did talk, Kristen.
When we did speak, I never knew if it was going to be the last time we would speak, so I always tried to remain calm. I felt that was the one thing I could do for David. I wanted him to sense that I loved him, that I could handle this, that, you know, we'd be all right. And I knew that his dialogue was highly scripted, as was mine. He could sense that.
I was always trying to say exactly what they had wanted me to say.
Such as?
Oh, exactly what their demands were. They wanted me to lie primarily and say that we were being held prisoner in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. They were trying to hide the fact that I was in this safe haven they have in Pakistan. And it was, you know, this that they're going to kill us and, you know, to try to frighten them. At one point, they talked about bringing in a local person they had arrested, and the Taliban had declared this local person a spy, and killing him in front of me on video as a way to really terrify my family and try to get more money. And Kristen was just incredible. We also exchanged letters at one point. The International Red Cross let us each write a letter to each other. My letter was essentially, you know, here are their demands. And this one line she wrote in her letter was, "You must be strong because I am strong." And those words and just the sound of her voice and this incredible calm, I don't know if readers can hear it, just kept me going for months. She was just extraordinary.
What did that take of you, Kristen?
You know, it took a lot. And I have to say, I have to thank my mother. You know, in a crisis, you lose sight of the basic things, eating, sleeping. My mother actually came in and stayed with me periodically throughout this whole ordeal. And she really just took care of all the basics. That enabled me to have, you know, to be able to rest, to be able to rush off to D.C., to have meetings with government officials, to still maintain my job. My employer was tremendously supportive. Kate
White. Did they know?
Initially, not in the first 2 weeks. And then I told Kate White, the editor-in-chief and the managing editor, and they were fantastic. They actually let me bring in a freelancer to cover for me on days when I had to be off at meetings. I never knew if and when I was going to get a call from David or the captors, so they were very flexible with my schedule. You know, everybody was tremendously supportive. David's colleagues as well helped me get in touch with, you know, people in Afghanistan who might be able to help, people in Pakistan. I had a lot of support, and for me, I'm a very independent person, so initially it was very hard to be asking for help, but I quickly got over that, and I took what was offered.
I bet you did. What did you, David, learn about the Taliban from your captors?
I was among the most hardline Taliban. It's called the Haqqani Network. It's run by the Haqqani family. I spent a lot of time with Badruddin Haqqani, who's sort of the number two commander of the network, and they were much more hardline than I think Taliban that live in Afghanistan. And I want to differentiate. I mean, again, this is a very stark thing I saw. This is, you know, the tribal areas, North Waziristan is a fulcrum where young Afghan and Pakistanis hang out with foreign militants. They're around al-Qaeda members. My guards referred to Osama bin Laden as Sheikh Osama. And they spoke of a prophecy where this army carrying black flags would emerge from Afghanistan and liberate the holy cities of Saudi Arabia. Very radical, you know, talking about activity beyond Afghanistan. That's not true of all Taliban. I think there are local Taliban fighting to control their valley or their village in southern Afghanistan. And they're maybe the focus of this hope of negotiations. But the tribal areas are very dangerous and very radical.
David Rode, he's a reporter for the New York Times. He and his wife, Kristen Mulvihill, have written a new book about his capture, his 7-month captivity. It's titled A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Asbury Park, New Jersey. Good morning, James.
Hello there, Diana. Thank you for your show. You're great.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask your two guests, don't you think that you're putting the next reporter who is captured in jeopardy by releasing all this information about the FBI monitoring the calls and stalling the negotiations? Don't you think the next person is going to be in a little jeopardy?
They knew this. They're very sophisticated, and they were aware that the FBI was involved in this case. They Googled me. I mean, again, this idea of the Taliban living in caves. You know, they Googled me. They Googled my reporting, and you know, they exaggerated what they found, but they're well aware that the U.S. government was involved from the beginning. They actually wanted direct negotiations with the U.S. government. They have this desire for respect. They want to be seen as this legitimate government. There are things we're not disclosing in this mm-hmm. book that we do feel could you know, create dangers in the future, and we've tried to be very careful about that. So it's a very legitimate point you raise, but I hope and I think we've done this in a safe way.
Your captors actually believed 2009 drone attack was because of you.
Yeah, they thought that the U.S. government was trying to hunt me down and kill me, and so they would move me to different locations in the tribal areas. And there was a drone strike about 100 yards outside of the house I was in.
And they would be trying to kill you for what reason, according to your captors?
They believed that every day they held me, they were delivering massive political blows to the American government. I explained to them that no one even knew about my case. It wasn't public, but it didn't matter. This is, again, this alternate reality. They thought that the, if you remember the American sea captain who was kidnapped by Somali pirates, they said, you know, the U.S., the story of snipers killing three of the pirates wasn't true. And what in fact had happened, they believed, was that the U.S. secretly paid a $25 million ransom. And it was just extraordinary, you know, how everything was sort of twisted and how they saw things.
And Kristen, mm-hmm. I realize that some people mm-hmm. had to know. But
yes.
how did you keep this secret from the vast majority of people around you?
You know, it was fairly easy at work because I was new to the magazine, so people didn't know my personality. They didn't know my normal schedule, if I was ducking out of the office for meetings and whatnot. I think going to work sort of maintained a sense of normalcy. I also, you know, our immediate family knew and some close friends, but we didn't really talk to extended family about it until, you know, midway through people started to notice that David wasn't responding to his
yeah,
emails and things
right.
like that. Yeah, yeah.
So you had no contact with anyone other than Kristen?
That was it, the two phone calls. Again, what was so odd about it, the situation, though, was that I was in captivity. My captors had DVDs and a DVD mm-hmm. player. Many of the DVDs were actually jihadi tapes glorifying suicide bombers. Again, presenting this, they would flash flags on the screen, and it would be the American flag, the British flag, the UN flag, the Indian flag. And then they also had DVDs of the HBO special Band of Brothers. And I watched that, and I watched the movie Wind Talkers with Nicolas Cage sitting with the Taliban in Waziristan. They are very much interact with the world, but they stay radical.
Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Cabot Creamery Cooperative. Five generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese. By the Overbrook Foundation, supporting CatalogChoice.org, a nonprofit service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail. And by Constant Contact, offering an event marketing service that provides registration tools to small businesses and nonprofits. ConstantContact.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the Roberts Court with New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak. He's recently written about how the Roberts Court has become the most conservative one in living memory and has reported that several of the court's written decisions have been unusually long but lacking in clarity. Join us.
We're back with David Rode and Kristen Mulvihill, husband and wife. He was held captive in Afghanistan, Pakistan for 7 months. His new book, written with his wife about his experience, is titled A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. Here's an email from Justin, who says, how does being taken as a hostage for 7 months change the way you look at the world, and has it changed what you're willing to do as a journalist?
My days as a war correspondent are over. I, you know, my wife and family have been through enough, and I'm, you know, committed to journalism and working as an investigative reporter at the Times. That was the job I had before I went on book leave and things went very wrong, and you know, and in terms of life, I mean, I appreciate the small things. I missed sort of having coffee in the morning with my wife. I missed going on walks with her. I missed seeing my family on holidays. It really it's a humbling experience, and I'm just incredibly lucky to be home and incredibly lucky to have her as my wife.
What about you, Kristen? How do you think the experience has changed you?
Has changed me.
Or affected you.
Affected me. I definitely am a believer in the power of positive thought. You know, later into the captivity, when it seemed like nothing we did was going to affect change, I really fell back on prayer and my faith. So I'm a big believer in miracles at this point. And also the same as David, you know, just appreciating the smaller moments in life. We had traveled a lot during our courtship and, you know, honeymoon in India and whatnot. And when he got home, we really just wanted to be home, you know, having coffee together in the morning, as he mentioned. So I think it's just really appreciating every moment as it comes and knowing that no phase is permanent, whether it's a wonderful phase or a disastrous phase, things change.
All right. To a caller in Silver Spring, Maryland. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning. Very interesting story, I have to say, and very interesting program. I know that after I read Mr. Rhodes' book about his captivity in Bosnia, and one thing that I did notice is that he thought that publicity in that instance was helpful, mm-hmm. and obviously in this instance it wasn't. And I think very fortunately he got it right both times. Mm. But what is other people are likely to be in this situation sometime in the future? And what's the difference? How do you make that decision? What are the factors that go into making such a high stakes and difficult decision?
David.
We're working with the Committee to Protect Journalists to try to develop some guidelines to help families that are in this position in the future. I think the most important first step is trying to identify the kidnappers. It's very hard to do what they want. And because there are governments, there was a kidnapping of a BBC reporter, Alan Johnston, in Gaza several years ago, and publicity helped him because the Palestinian Authority did not want bad publicity. So if the kidnappers care about international opinion, then it helps to publicize. I've spoken with people that were imprisoned in Iran, and there is a sense that the Iranian government does respond to publicity, and that if bad press, particularly in Europe, they will respond to. But people who've been held by jihadists, they just want to defy Western public opinion. They're eager to do it, and it really publicity doesn't help in those cases.
David, tell us about your escape.
After 7 months, we were just despondent, and recently our kidnapper had announced to us that the only reason President Obama had visited Saudi Arabia in the spring of 2009 was to talk about my case. That's again how deluded they were. And secondly, we were moved to a new house that was very close to the Pakistani military base in Miranshah. And this goes back to this theme, and this situation still exists today. The Pakistani military is not confronted the Taliban in this area. Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber whose truck bomb failed to go off, was trained right where I was held in North Waziristan. We were held only 0.3 miles from this base. Our captors did not fear the Pakistani military trying to come find us. We snuck out at night while our guards slept, used a rope I had found, a car tow rope, to lower ourselves down a wall. It took us only 10 minutes to walk to this base. That's how close we were. We were nearly shot by the guards at the base. They thought we were potentially suicide bombers. I had a very long beard at that point, and that my guards forced me to grow. And we held up our hands for 10 minutes, were forced to lie on the ground, and eventually we took off our shirts, and they finally let us on this base. And I am a very brave and this very moderate, and I want to emphasize there are moderates in the region. These people saved my life. A young army captain let me call home. We were afraid that these soldiers could potentially hold us back to the Taliban, and I called home, and Kristen wasn't home, actually, and my mother-in-law picked up the phone, and she did an extraordinary job of getting all the details right, the name of the base, the name of the town, and then all of Kristen's hard work paid off.
How did you actually find out?
I was actually out at dinner, something I hadn't done in like 7 months. But toward the end, I decided I would make plans because maybe something would happen if I was busy. And I was right. My mother called me on the cell phone and said David had escaped. You know, my first thought was, oh, no.
Oh,
that's so
my
dangerous.
God. Yes.
You know, it's one thing to get out of a house. It's another to get out of the tribal areas of Pakistan.
Sure.
So I was terrified. I ran home. My my mother had, as he said, had written all the details out. She had them on sticky notes, so there were sticky notes all over the sofa. And very quickly, you know, myself, the lawyer from the New York Times, my mom, and the foreign editor started calling, you know, Richard Holbrooke, Hillary Clinton, all the officials we had met with in the United States. And they, in turn, contacted their Pakistani counterparts and said, "We know that David is in Pakistan. Please make sure he is safely exited from the country."
And what happened then?
There was several hours of kind of nervous waiting, and then the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI, flew in a helicopter and flew us out from this base. But I what is disappointing is that, you know, I escaped 17 months ago. I wrote about this in the New York Times a year ago. And the ISI is still believed to be supporting the Taliban, the Pakistani Military Intelligence Service. Last month, the Obama administration increased our military aid to the Pakistani military to $2 billion a year. Many experts are frustrated by the lack of cooperation from the Pakistani military. And, you know, they're saying we should consider maybe, you know, threatening to cut that aid. But this problem continues. And as long as the Taliban have these safe havens in Pakistan, the U.S. surge in Afghanistan won't work. The Taliban will simply retreat over the border, wait in Pakistan, and they don't appear to be serious about negotiating because they know they can just sort of wait us out safely in Pakistan.
It's interesting, Kristen, because when David was released, apparently you began to feel at odds with his newspaper.
Yes, I mean, they pointed out to me that they had kept this private for so long, but they're a news organization, and this was big news, and they wanted to report the story. So there was a bit of a shift in those initial hours after he was released. Yes.
But why not print it then?
My one of the most difficult decisions made in the captivity was that I escaped with the Afghan journalist who was with me. Our driver, and I do not blame him for this, had started cooperating with our guards and carrying a gun. And we had talked to the driver about escaping, and he had told the guards in the past weeks earlier. So we did not include the driver in our escape. And he was still trapped. We did help his family send in a tribal delegation. And 5 weeks after our escape, the driver was essentially left alone by his guards, and he was able to flee.
He escaped, safely returned
to his family. And you know, I'm elated he came home. I don't blame him. He was trying to survive by playing along at that time. So, you know, I didn't want our escape reported initially. The Times said, "You have no idea, you know, how hard it's been to, you know, keep this quiet." And they reported it, and everything worked out well. Overall, the paper was absolutely tremendous.
Yes, they were.
They were so supportive, and we were so lucky to have their backing.
And where were you reunited?
At the airport in Dubai.
Why?
That was always the plan. I would fly over and meet David. He actually beat me to Dubai, and, you know, came running towards me when I saw him in the airport. And yeah, it was lovely reunion. And he looked just as he did the day he left, which was really shocking
you
to me.
You had shaven.
I got to Dubai, you know, took my first shower in 7 months, shaved the beard, and put on, you know, my Western clothes, which I hadn't worn. And
he had bought flowers, actually, which was a nice touch.
And she looked absolutely beautiful.
All right, let's go to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. I would like to ask your guest, did he think about writing a book while he was held captive? And it seems to me like some of this risk that journalists take is due to the competition, and it makes me wonder, you know, how much sense does some of this make? You know, some of these interviews can probably be conducted by phone or two-way radio. And also, you know, I thought that'd be, has he been approached about a movie or anything like that? Because I thought would be a good premise for a movie would be a journalist who was seeking fortune and fame, sought to be kidnapped and then get released, and then that, you know, it all ends happily ever after. But anyway, those are my questions. And
all
I
right.
Appreciate an answer.
Thanks.
Again, actually, every questioner today has had very legitimate issues. It was a mistake for me to go to this interview. I went too quickly. I should have tried to. I did speak to these other journalists, and I did find out about his. But I had the kidnappers.
Your own pride was at work.
Well, I wanted this. You know, it was competition, and it's a dangerous business, and it's sort of a race to the bottom. And I had his phone number. I knew his name. I left all this information for my colleagues when I went to the interview at the village where I was meeting him. You know, I tried to do everything I could. And again, he had done these previous interviews, and everything went wrong. So, you know, and then I was literally from the beginning of the kidnapping, you know, ashamed of it, frankly, and felt terrible about what my family and wife were going through. I was very worried about the lives of Tahir and Assad, and I did not plan to write anything. And when I came home, I didn't want to write anything. I wrote this book, you know, primarily to, and wrote the series for the New York Times, primarily to let people know about what is still happening in the tribal areas of Pakistan. And how it, you know, this case in Portland of the young man who wanted to set off the bomb at the tree lighting ceremony, he had contacts with Pakistan, and this continues today. But secondly, I want my wife to get the recognition she deserves.
Of course.
And there people ask about a movie. There really isn't that much interest in a movie, and I'm kind of torn. I mean, this wasn't my finest hour, and the caller's right. But it was a disaster, and you know, I've spoken to journalism students and just told them to be careful and avoid this kind of catastrophe.
You know, I wonder, Kristen, mm-hmm. when this whole thing began, did you assume that the United States had some plan for dealing with exactly this kind of situation?
I assume there was probably a lot going on behind the scenes that I didn't know about. Over time, I came to realize that, you know, they didn't know where David was. I actually met with a senior military official who told me, you know, we don't have a fix on his location. And if he is in Pakistan, we can't go in and get him. They had the sense that he was in Miram Shah on a compound. And when I asked what the radius of this compound was, he said 20 square miles. So it was like finding a needle in a haystack. And they didn't know where he was specifically.
But this coordinated effort mm-hmm. doesn't really exist. I mean, a standard plan for going after people held captive doesn't exist.
Every kidnapping is different. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important to identify the kidnapper immediately. Is it a low-level criminal who, you know, can't take someone to, let's say, a safe area in Pakistan and hold them for months? That's a very different situation from a more senior group. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my case, there was actually just a story in The Nation about what happened after our release. The Haqqani Network, you know, it looks like they were involved in my case from very, very early on. They were furious, and they thought that there had possibly been a secret ransom paid to the guards. They arrested a couple of the guards who were related to my kidnapper, and there was no ransom paid. They then turned these two men over to Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, which we talked about earlier. And according to this recent story, the Pakistani intelligence interrogated them, wanted to know if they had cheated the Haqqanis out of money and then released them. So instead of Pakistani intelligence turning these people over to American authorities, you know, they released them, and there continues to be suspicion that the Pakistanis are aiding the Haqqani Afghan Taliban faction.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. One last call from Rebecca in St. Louis, Missouri. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm so glad that you got out safely.
Thank you.
I had a question about, you talked about the young men involved were living in their own world, and they're not realistic. But you don't mention, and I've just watched your book, I have not read it. You don't mention any women in the situation. In that big an area, there has to be quite a few women.
The local culture, the Pashtun culture, is very conservative, and they basically keep women in these, you know, the burqas when they do leave their homes, the head-to-toe blue veils you see. That's traditional, and that's existed for thousands of years. The Taliban have taken that to an extreme. So I had no interactions with women whatsoever throughout the 7 months and 10 days I was in captivity. I did see how women live in the tribal areas, and I feel for the people of the tribal areas. It's a destitute area. It's been neglected for years by Pakistan and the United States, and we used that as a sort of launching pad for when we were backing the anti-Soviet Mujahideen in the 80s. This has all come back to haunt us. We supported Islamic fundamentalism in the 80s, and now we're kind of, you know, reaping the fallback from that. But I never had any interaction with women.
From your captivity, David, do you have any better understanding of whether bin Laden is still alive?
I don't. I mean, and there's speculation he's somewhere in the tribal areas of Pakistan. I just know that, you know, he was supported and very unpopular among my Afghan Taliban guards.
Very unpopular.
No, very popular.
Very popular.
And they sort of saw themselves, you know, all defending themselves against this Western conspiracy. But to repeat, I was among the most hardline Taliban. The tribal areas of Pakistan are very different from, you know, local Taliban inside Afghanistan. They're primarily interested in fighting in Afghanistan itself and not interested in sort of an international jihad. It's two separate but related problems.
Well, I do echo our callers thinking we're glad you got home.
I'm the happiest of all.
Thank you.
David Rode, he's a reporter for the New York Times, winner of two Pulitzer Prizes in journalism. Kristen Mulvey Hill, his wife, together they have written a new book. It's titled A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. Congratulations to both of you.
Thanks for listening,
all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.